the hardest thing for leaders is to really not know the answers. You're there to know the questions. That is incredibly uncomfortable for most CEOs because it's not what they're paid to do.
David Kidder has an adage. His life's work isn't all about him. In other words, he's not focusing on himself. After all, successes mean nothing unless you're sharing those victories with the people around you. David's mission is a simple one: to help enterprises build the ever-elusive, new, profitable business units. In today's business world, the average lifespan of a Fortune 500 company is under 20 years. Of the Fortune 500 firms that existed in 1955, 88% are gone. The reasons why are many, and finding the answers is tough. In order to increase their health span, established enterprises must incubate, launch, and acquire new products and services. But creating something new and bringing it to life from inside a large established corporation can be challenging. Sometimes the existing cash cow, operational efficiency, and bureaucracy kills whatever new profit center might become before it has a chance to mature. David knows all of this too well. As an experienced entrepreneur, co-founder, and CEO of Bionic, he sees these problems firsthand. On this episode of Hidden in Plain Sight, David joins me for a candid conversation about the challenges big businesses face today, his book, New to Big, and the role that data plays in all of this. Let's jump into today's episode of Hidden in Plain Sight with David Kidder.
This season of Hidden in Plain Sight is brought to you exclusively by our friends at Splunk, the Data to Everything platform. Splunk helps organizations worldwide turn data into doing. It's time for data to be more than a record of what happened. It's time to make things happen. Learn more at splunk.com or by clicking the link in our show notes.
David, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm very grateful to be here and excited about our conversation today.
I'm excited to talk to you. And I think it's really interesting that you're returning to work. You're getting back out there in New York and the economy is coming back, or is it a little bit, what's the hesitation here? I would love to get your take on it. David, how are you?
I'm well. I am back in my office here in our beautiful space, which is largely empty. But we have a couple people here today with me, which is wonderful. And just trying to get back to a little bit of normalcy, kind of Monday, Tuesdays here and the rest at my home in Westchester, where my wife and three sons are with me there. So, but the city's coming back a little bit, but definitely feels smaller right now. And so the next decade is going to be quite interesting as we restore confidence and community here.
I couldn't agree more. So restoring, you know, confidence and community, I think those are really interesting topics. And the work you do is kind of related to that, right? Like it's when you're going into an enterprise, when you're working with them, helping them through a digital transformation or thinking more entrepreneurially, you really have to focus on that community aspect. So I'll let you take it away here, but tell us about what you do and the work.
Yeah, so I've been an entrepreneur for now for 25 years, had three venture-backed startups, two worked, one didn't, and then been scaling up Bionic now for 7 years to a little over 50 people. And it's like a collective private army of entrepreneurs and venture capitalists, and we work with some of the largest companies in the world at the CEO and leadership level, refounding them. And we do that work both in mindset and systems around this idea that we wrote in a book called New to Big, which is the idea that the big to bigger of large organizations is really about efficiency. It's about planning and optimization. And it has sort of a total addressable marketplace view of the world. And if you're going for growth, which everyone needs to do now, the difference between going for markets is really a shift from, we call it TAM to TAP. The total addressable problem or need is really about discovery. It's not planning, it's the opposite. And that's where the idea that venture capital and entrepreneurship are literally forms of management. In the same way an MBA administrates the big to bigger, the skill that most organizations have lost or never had is really around mindset and systems that create growth. And I can talk in more detail about that today.
Very cool. Yeah, I love the mindset shift from TAM to TAP. TAP is more about creating new categories, new markets, finding new pains and solving them. So I think that's a very cool approach. How has your career changed over the years? And you can't go through the whole thing, but if you were to give us a distilled version, what's your career been and how does that help inform the work you do now?
Well, at a very kind of meta level, I'm sure you've had this experience where you work for like a week on a PowerPoint, right? And then the PowerPoint crashes and you'll literally want to cut your finger off to get it back, and it's lost. But when you sit down and do the work again to rewrite the deck or the presentation or the document, it takes like, you know, 1/10 the time. And building companies as a founder and CEO is sort of the same journey. You just learn how to do it, right? And so I'm my fourth one. And as you get better at that, you focus on higher level problems as you learn the skills of assembly and leading. And my last two or three have been in services and software, whereas this one is a bit in a way like an accidental startup. I wrote a book called The Startup Playbook about 10 years ago, where I went out and interviewed about 40 entrepreneurs who you would know by name, Elon Musk and Sarah Blakely and Reid Hoffman of LinkedIn fame, who wrote the foreword, and asked them, how do you bet your life? Like, how do you pick your ideas? And they all effectively said the same five lenses, the same five criteria. And that became the basis of both growth mindset and idea selection that we started scaling as a methodology that has led to, you know, really the transformations of P&G and Citigroup and Nike and many others that we've been working with. So it's become a process, and we've really had a huge impact on them, and they've had a huge impact on us.
So can you tell us some about those five principles, and maybe if we could talk through kind of a case study, whether it's P&G or any of the clients that you have that you where you can share? I would love to dive into a case study with you.
Sure. So the five lenses from the Startup Playbook were really answer the question of every entrepreneur, which is, how do you bet your life? What are the qualities of the idea and the execution that lead to extraordinary outcomes? So when you're, as an investor, I've done about 40 angel investments over the last 15 years. You never invest in an entrepreneur who loves their idea. You want them to be obsessed with a customer problem. And that allows them to set down biases about making an idea work, as opposed to just being completely open to however the problem is solved. And so the idea question of like, what does the idea have to be successful, really is really where these five lenses come in. So the first lens is the idea of proprietary giftedness. Why you? What's your secret? Why now? And the answer to that has to lead to an unfair advantage. So if you're just kind of chasing white space, or you're trying to, you know, compete with other press releases in a space, very rarely does that work. So that's the first lens. It's a high hurdle. Secondly is that you have extreme focus, both on the problem and the obsession. So ironically, like the more things you do as an entrepreneur, the more likely you are to fail. So optionality in a way is your enemy. So getting that extreme focus is hugely important. So you have to be able to test very quickly and get to the right answer. And as my friend Dick Costolo of Twitter fame once said, it's like you want to run down the dark alleys to find the one that has the light. The third lens is you got to build painkillers and not vitamins. And so I've learned that 10 years ago and been kind of repeating it for years. But it's the idea that chronic, lifelong, malignant pain is a great place to solve in. When you've made a vitamin, people try it once and set it down, or they stop pain. It's a feature. It's a nice to have. The fourth and fifth lens are really about executing. So most solutions to a need don't survive those first three lenses. Proprietary gift, extreme focus, the painkiller is the first barrier. The second sort of phase of these things is execution. So the fourth lens is the idea of 10X. And this is largely misunderstood because 10X is something that's impossible to replicate, and it takes a long period of time. So if you have a quality of a thing, of your solution that can be 10X, you want to asymmetrically fund that so that happens, which leads to the fifth lens, which is you want to build a monopoly. You want to have hooks and barbs with intention, so customers stay with you long enough where they feel the impact and you can solve the whole problem. Proprietary gift, extreme focus, there's a painkiller that has a 10X impact that's permanent, is a really high bar to build a lasting big company. And that's with the beginning of idea selection. It's very hard for big companies to do. So one more minute and I'll hand the ball back to you here.
Yeah, sure.
When you look at large organizations on how they create growth, about 70 to 80% of all growth come from 7 to 8% of capital deployed. So if I invest in 100 things, 7 or 8, or I invest in 10, 7% of that capital will become the unbounded returns. They'll be the billions of dollars of value. The rest is going to go to zero, or you get your money back. And so when you go back to the beginning, you say, well, why do we make those bets? They have two qualities. One is high conviction. Why us? Why now? I.e. the proprietary gift and market timing. And secondly is non-consensus, meaning you make all of your money with the ideas with the highest disagreement rate. So if you can't have high non-consensus decision-making that's based on evidence, you're learning nothing new. You're just going after that total addressable marketplace view of the world, which is what the big to bigger does. So it's really hard to get these systems, mindsets, and kind of the mechanics right. And Bionic's work today is around setting up the systematic how of how to do that as a way of working. I didn't answer your first question, which was give us a case study, but I've been talking a lot. So I'll get to that throughout our conversation.
No, setting up the premise is more important in many ways. So yeah, you definitely, you know, created a new lens that we can look at these challenges that enterprises are facing through. And I think, you know, I'd be curious to know, when you bring that lens to an enterprise, what do you hear now? Is this something where they're like, yes, we know, we're trying to implement it now? Or is it something where they're very much, you know, kind of bristle at it? What's the average take?
At the end of the day, it's really about the leader. In the past, you know, the last 7 years, I've been sort of evangelizing that disruption is real, right? And we no longer have to do that because of COVID. Disruption is real. And it really takes us back to the root of, you know, the needs of customers have changed. So whoever learns the fastest is going to win in solving those new needs. It could be model innovation, could be the transformation of your industry, which ultimately means that you have to learn very quickly. If the organization can't learn, and it's trying to resist, you know, change because they want to hold on to their goals in 2019, they're in deep trouble because, you know, that shift, you have to have matched the internal learning velocity with the external rate of change. Once you have that in equilibrium, you can create growth. That really is about leadership, which goes to your first question, which is what's so hard, is really the deep question of like, does the organization tell the truth? You know, most organizations, they do so few things, they all have to work. So the cost of failure is so high that no one will tell the truth because they're making their ideas work, which is kind of fatal. The only way to get to the truth is to lower the cost of failure so people can say it, right? And so they can create the safety and vulnerability and the commercial evidence to tell the truth. So you have leaders who can invest in people who are based on truth in the marketplace and in themselves. Once that gets established, to your going all the way back to your prior question, the impact is extraordinary because they stop launching ideas that prematurely scale solutions in search of a problem. And that's where the fatal economic outcome happens in big companies, is that their technology, you know, in search of a problem, their inside out views of the world, most of their innovation or growth is really about them. How do we fix our margin? How do we make our model work? It's not really obsession from the outside in, which is where growth lives.
Very cool. And when you say, you know, where growth lives, are, you know, you're talking kind of about that divine discontent from the marketplace, from who they're serving. What are some ways that you kind of get a handle on what the market wants and kind of like triangulate into, okay, here's the divine discontent. Here's a better way to serve. How do you get to that, you know, 7 to 8% that of capital invested that generates all the returns?
Well, you have to increase the volume of bets you make. And so to do that, you have to reframe that, going back to the beginning, that TAM to TAP concept. We got to move from a total addressable marketplace view of the world, which is inside out and really about, you know, kind of efficiency, you know, existing behaviors and budgets, to the outside in. And that's where the portfolio around the total addressable problem or need comes in. We want to reframe around the actual customer problem and then go back to the organization and say, who has solutions, who has secrets to solve that need? And that's where, rather than inventing R&D and launching new tech or new solutions, once we find the proprietary gift of the company, we then can draw that out and start solving the problem. The ability to solve the problem is not going to be narrowed down in a spreadsheet from 50 ideas down to 5 that we select, because that's consensus. These are, quote, good ideas. We want to let the portfolio of bets teach us the answer, i.e., we want a lot of failure run down dark alleys, i.e. Dick Costolo, to show us the light. And that can only happen because we're running experimentation. So in a way, we're sort of ending the era of solving for the customer. Here, customer, let me tell you about my great XYZ, to solving it with them, right? Solving it with them means that you have to be experimenting with them because in many cases, they don't even know. They can't even tell you. So classic market research and studying, if you go ask them, do you need this? The answer is, I'm fine. But in reality, they do. And the only way to get to that truth is through experimentation, because behaviors don't lie. Behavior and experimentation is where truth lives, and we want to get to as fast as possible. And that nature of the work is what we do.
Very cool. And when it comes to case studies or specific examples or stories you like to tell, do any come to mind? And feel free to anonymize if it makes it easier to share.
No, I'll give you one anonymous one, but I'll give you some one public ones. And if you go to our website, onbionic.com, and you can always reach me at david@onbionic.com. And we do lots of keynoting and speaking, but the company itself really does growth transformation. We're actually launching, I think in a week or two, our new impact page, which will have 5 case studies across our partners from P&G to Exelon, Citigroup, Nike, and others. Also ABI InBev, that talk really about their journeys, about how they implemented this model that we call the Growth OS and the impact of that. You know, today Citigroup, led by Vanessa Colella and originally co-founded with Debbie Hopkins, really has led to a transformation of the company. They took the model and they advanced it. They made it their own, but ultimately they have investment bodies we call growth boards, funding portfolios, which is framed in the work of discovery, we call it Discover, and they have armies of entrepreneurs, right, that are learning how to validate, which is effectively lean for enterprise. So that growth board with Discover plus validate creates an operating rhythm we call the Growth OS that allows leadership to meet with solutions to problems to create growth on a regular basis, kind of every 60 to 90 days. The fourth element of that piece, growth board, validate, discover, is called growth ops, is the ability to go fast. We want to bring the functions, marketing, sales, regulatory, compliance, et cetera, into a place where they themselves can go fast, because their job in many cases is to de-risk the company. But if we can lower the cost of risk, they can launch things, you know, on a single contract for 100 customers as opposed to millions. And that creates the speed. We have a partner today in the CPG food space that would take, you know, a year to get to marketplace with new ideas that now can get to first dollar revenue in 17 days. You know, in the case of Citigroup, they're launching, you know, over 100 startups a year across their P&Ls. And Vanessa's built a whole venture group launching some extraordinary startups that are based on the proprietary gift of the company. In the case of ZX Ventures, which is the disruptive arm of ABI led by Pedro Arp, you know, that whole team has scaled this to, you know, a couple thousand people now and, you know, single digit billions in revenue doing this work at scale. And they've invested in portfolios of needs and problems where they're rediscovering the question of why us. And they've gotten that answer. It's really incredible to see the whole organization, both in growth mindset and entrepreneurism, become how they lead the organization. It's amazing.
Very cool. And yeah, anytime we talk about mindset shifts over hundreds or, you know, maybe starting with just a handful and then getting to dozens and then hundreds of people, that is a tremendous accomplishment. When you were writing New to Big, what insights did you have around writing this book, and how have those changed? You know, after you publish a book, after you give a talk, often you'll have the best thought or what you wish you would have said. Tell me what that process is like. Tell us about the book. And then if there's anything you wish you included, feel free to say that now.
Well, it's important to over-communicate, you know, the brains behind this. We have, of course, the whole organization. Bionic is New to Big, and it's an expression of that. I kind of evangelize the giftedness of an amazing team. And just my co-author, Christina Wallace, who now is a professor at Harvard Business School, who teaches this now. She's amazing. So I had a great team. But I do keynotes now for leadership team, boards, large organizations all over the world. And you know, within an hour, we can take a group from, you know, one fixed mindset to a growth mindset and the ability to really ignite change very quickly. The thing about the book is that I think what I misunderstood was how much companies need process, right? Process creates safety, process creates measurement and predictability. And as an entrepreneur, where things are fairly loose until you get to scale, I didn't understand how important it was to get people to tell the truth until they knew where they were on the journey. And that's both for the company, as the employees, as is for leadership. They have very different roles. When you're at the top of a company, you're there to bring answers, right? You have accrued incredible learning and experience, and you've seen it all. But in the case of growth, you're actually trying to, you know, create an environment where, in a way, you're almost peers with your entrepreneurs. You're there to create unfair advantage, which is what a VC does, with entrepreneurs who are trying to bring new commercial truth. If they can't bring truth, then you're never going to get to new growth, which means you have to sort of break your addiction to being right and become a question-driven leader. And so in the book, we go through the modeling of what that is, both the how, the process, these elements, these four elements, but also how to learn how to invest. How do you invest in something that will become a $1 billion outcome? And that exists today. In the venture capital world, you have seed ABC rounds and beyond, but those are the primary ones that kind of get you from like first dollar to scalable dollars. And each one of those stages of investments are about discovery. They're about learning. And so you have to ask a completely different set of questions that are not very often, not even economic in the beginning, to take an idea from a zygote to a 5-year-old to a 10-year-old to an ugly teenager. Each one of those stages is like raising a kid. You can't show up to a 5-year-old kid and say, well, how fast can you run? You know, will you promise to be an Olympian? Or I'll feed you if you can guarantee it. Like, that's what large companies do. And it's completely fatal. So we fix that, and leadership become growth leaders who know how to invest with confidence in the unknowable.
Very cool. And when leaders are beginning to invest in the unknowable and they're getting this started, what are some of the common challenges that you hear, or the kind of growing pains that come when an organization tries to implement this?
One is incentives, right? Right today, the most organizations at scale are designed and incentivized to defeat risk. So the very nature of, you know, creating growth is to embrace risk, but do it cheaply and then make it big. So if the whole company is designed to defeat growth, which I would argue most organizations are, that's a pretty fatal place to start. So you have to really change the way the organization works and thinks and pays to as a foundational level if you want to incentivize, you know, the transformation that leads to, you know, disruptive outcomes. So incentive is huge. Secondly, answers is at the top, is that the hardest thing for leaders is to really not know the answers, right? You're there to know the questions. That is incredibly uncomfortable for most CEOs because it's not what they're paid to do, right? They're paid to like come with answers. And so where do you start is really a very difficult thing for most CEOs to do. But once they have good news is they're all brilliant. She or he is just incredible at, like, you know, growing for themselves. They can figure it out and get good at this very quickly. And that really just changes the whole company. Once a CEO does something once, it gets repeated 1,000 times. So if she, you know, creates permission or she promotes in a moment of failure, you know, everybody will tell how this amazing, you know, CEO and what she did to this group really enforces safety and learning. And you only need to do it a couple of times to change a whole company.
Yeah, such a good reminder. So you're out there, you're consulting and you're working and you're really enabling so many of these different enterprises. You're giving speeches. What's your learning routine like? I'd imagine, you know, you're talking to people, listening to podcasts, reading books. How have you gone about formalizing that routine over the years so you're getting yourself the best information or the most useful information?
I have this thing called my own operating system, the KOS, Kidder Operating System. I'm working on this with my sons, my three sons. Well, two of them who are now teenagers. So whenever I look at, like, you know, failure in myself or them, or, you know, I miss something, I don't look at the actual outcome. I look at the system. And so you're asking the right question, which is, what's the system of learning? So I have very specific systems that I use to collect understanding, learning insights that are sort of like slow, medium, fast sort of speed. So on the slow side is just, I listen on Audible, probably 30 to 50 books a year. I'm medically ADD. And so it's easier for me to learn that way. You know, on the fast side, I use Google Alerts. I have Google Alerts for all sorts of my partners, but my team and ideas. And so I bring information into my life very quickly. I'm a complete addict for a bunch of different websites, very broad range, left and right, center. And on the slow learning side is just really, you know, white papers. You know, I do follow pretty deeply the academic research in learning and bias. I have an amazing board of advisors, which includes some of the thought leaders in the world who are, you know, Adam Grant out of Penn and Linda Hill out of Harvard, Justin Berg out of Stanford, Jenna McChrystal of the McChrystal Group. So I'm very blessed, very fortunate to have just an amazing, Rita McGrath at Columbia. Very blessed to have some amazing people who I get to converse with on what they're learning. And so I think this is an example of the ecosystem of data you pull to you, the ecosystem you participate in, but also that you've built around you that accelerates your learning velocity for yourself.
Well said. That's an amazing board and support group there. So when you are thinking about collecting the data or enacting a system inside an organization to collect data around this, I would imagine this is where it gets challenging, but also very rewarding. What type of data are you going about quantifying and trying to, you know, have on hand with your partners as you build these bets?
Let's just frame that in two different data sets. So the first one is, and probably I would say most important, is that TAM to TAP concept, which is, how do we value a marketplace that has not yet emerged, right? That's the TAM to TAP. So marketplace that exists, we can measure because there's budgets, there's behavior. You can talk to it. People understand it. But in the reframing of a marketplace around a customer problem or need, very often there's a distinction between the actual value of the behavior commercially today and what it's becoming, the size of it. So in that context, you have to be able to do the experimentation and then build up cases that prove how big is the total addressable need in the world for something. And then you lean into that with your scale. So that's one area of measurement. The second is just about how do you lead growth at an organizational level in the same way you lead efficiency. So when you have lean manufacturing, you have Six Sigma, you have all these tools, most organizations, ERP systems, CRM, supply chain, they look at data all day long as tools to manage what's happening and how do they make decisions. It's hard data because it's being experienced in real time. You know, growth is dealt with in sort of more softer outcomes that happen a little slower, but really because discovery takes time. There isn't empirical data on a real-time basis, but there is data on day-to-day, week-to-week basis, if you know how to measure it. So the key KPIs across the stages of ideas or solutions to a need could be the case of user adoption, repeatable cycles, ideas like we call the God metric, which are usually baskets of metrics that signal the growth rate of the organization, maybe that not economical, but they may be market share or market demand. And so we can look at those and value the portfolios in aggregate. So if I'm building a disruptive group, I might have 10 solutions, maybe went from 100 bets down to one over a period of 3 or 4 years through my funnel. I want to see at what speed am I failing? Like how quickly am I going from 100 to 50 to 20 to 10 to 2 through those funnels in each portfolio? And so then I need to roll up that number and say, great, I have $2 billion in revenue, $1 billion, $5 billion across 10 ideas, which is growing the fastest. So how do I allocate my resources? Those are very empirical things. But I also have to look at the organization, right? I need to see like, what's my cost of learning? What's my cost of talent development? When I'm putting 100 kids in art class, who can I tell? Who can I find out in 5 minutes who can draw? Right, it's a metaphor for entrepreneurship. You don't need the whole company, but you do need the special forces. And so I want to build skills and capital and measurement so I get the right people in the right jobs to create growth. And so those are another area of measurement that I think we've mastered at Bionic with our partners at scale that I'm pretty sure no company in the world has done today. You know, at a way that a company as big as P&G or otherwise can lead and manage growth in the same way they do the big to big efficiency model.
That's fascinating. And David, if we shift back a bit to your time as co-founder and CEO of Clickable, are there any stories or times from those days that inform the work you do now or lessons that you reflect on where you're like, wow, that's really, really helped me for decades after that? I had no idea it would. Any surprising stories there?
Oh my God. We need another podcast series on that journey. Yeah, I mean, I would say that the entire startup playbook came out of that journey. Clickable really helped me learn a couple of hard lessons, but also that, you know, success is a bad educator in many cases. It masks typically fatal liabilities in leadership. And it also teaches you that the outside forces are the primary reasons why you're able to grow a company fast. And so getting your timing right, but also understanding the why us, why now question is really important. The other element is just about a focus. You know, never build two companies at once, right? It's like at Clickable, I built a absolutely beautiful Siamese twin-headed kid, right? It was like culturally, technology, we had, 200 people and it was just scaling up. But in reality, I was building two companies at once. And that was a really big mistake because you love your company and maybe your investors do, but ultimately the marketplace has to value that and it doesn't know how to value it. And so we end up this is a terrible way to describe it. We kind of had to tear our kid in half and rebuild them and by merging them with other companies. And that's never a really good outcome. So that really is where that second lesson it really comes from is the idea of extreme focus and proprietary giftedness. But I'm very grateful for the experience because it led to the startup playbook. I went out and I asked some really hard questions about how did I miss those decisions as I was scaling this up? And I learned them because I went very deep in those interviews.
Sure. And David, when you're thinking about working with new enterprises now, or maybe just where the landscape is headed, I really want to get your take on this. So depending on how you look at it, there's about $4 trillion on corporate balance sheets right now. And do you think that we're going to see a flurry of M&A activity over the coming years, of investment, of buybacks? What do you think corporations are going to do with all of this cash on hand?
I mean, it's interesting because I think the McKinsey Buffett era would really emphasize buybacks, but because there's this idea that if we can't deploy that capital more efficiency and innovation, then we would, you know, effectively go after the cap table. I think we're paying the price for that. I think for, you know, decades, we have incentivized short-termism. We've incentivized it, which has led to all sorts of catastrophic decisions on strategy and long-term, you know, outcomes, thinking long-term. In fact, I'm an investor in Eric Ries's company, Long-Term Stock Exchange, LTSE, to go after this.
Love it.
Yeah, because it's a fatal idea. Is that, I mean, governance is really important, of course. But if you are a leader and you don't know how to spend your money towards innovation because you're either paying down debt you used to borrow to build up your share price in buybacks, then, you know, ultimately, you know, I think you're in trouble. So I would hope with all this cash that people, I think most business case studies support this today, is that whoever invests in the downturn almost always turns out to win the spaces or win marketplaces when they come out of it. And I hope that capital allocation and the growth leadership happens so that we have stronger companies and a stronger states and stronger country, because we're going to need it. We are going into a decade of very significant geopolitical economic change. And we have to have incredible foundational strength on the balance sheet, all the way to the mindset of leaders to get through this. And we're going to need to invest to do that. So I hope they deploy it well.
Completely agree. And it's obviously going to be, it is a tumultuous time. It's challenging culturally. There's a lot going on. How do you keep perspective, right? Because you mentioned checking all those websites earlier. Do you have a digital detox day? You have a family. You have three sons that you mentioned. I also have three sons. Both are under three. So it's tempting now to like get engaged and you want to capitalize on the opportunities. But do you find yourself taking digital detoxes more often? What's your process like there for kind of taking a step back and getting perspective?
I think I'm somewhat of a philosophical leader at my companies, but I'll tell you with some vulnerability that I one of my mentors and beloved mentors was my uncle Roger Fransecki. He was a clinical psychologist and sat on a bunch of boards, coached a lot of CEOs, and he coached me since I was 16. He sold his company at age 70, which is now in 2014, and he sadly, you know, 9 months later, died of brain cancer. But on his deathbed, and last week before he died, I was the last one to see him, he shared this word of wisdom to me. He said, "Don't focus on who you are to the world, focus on who you're becoming." So before Michelle wrote her book, I've been talking about becoming for a long time. And it's really around the idea that when you get to the top, you realize there's nothing there. It doesn't really matter what your ambition was. Once you achieve it, it's incredibly dissatisfying. So really fall in love with the journey, the grind, and focus on, let it shape you. And so the question is, how do you do that well? I've done a ton of deep work over the last 5-6 years and longer, but very significant deep work in that context. And I've just built a system of how I lead myself every day that's really around three tools. The first is a 5-minute journal, and I use an app called Day One. And I have a way I start and end my day that is really begins with gratefulness. I kind of three bullets in each one of these things: asks of God and the universe, but also observations about the journey. And then I close the day similarly. My sons do this now too, around like, wow, you know, revelations, things that really surprised me about the day, like the return of that, things that drain my energy. Where did my energy get drained? And also, what can I handle better? And so those journals sort of begin and end my day, take very little time, but they anchor me. The second thing is I use an app, which I love, called Waking Up by Sam Harris. It's probably one of the more advanced sort of meditated apps out there, but it just helps you understand your consciousness and your life and understanding who you are and who you're becoming. And lastly is I use this app called Productive. And I've worked on this for a couple of years now. Again, my sons use this, which is really about habits. And there's this great book that they've read called The Slight Edge which talks about the greatest force in the universe. This is a famous line from Einstein, is compounding interest. So what habits, what small little things that take 1 minute, 5 minutes, 10 minutes a day done consistently can lead to extraordinary results. And so I have programmed like software, like algorithms, the morning, noon, and night of my life to begin, reflect, and close well in my relationship with myself, my family, my company, and the world. That's taken many years to build, but it's a really powerful tool set that creates systems for change and impact. So that's really how I lead myself. Let me close on this last thing, which is I'll just say that this is an unprecedented time in COVID. And so I think we all are sort of, anybody who says they're thriving right now, I don't believe it. I think we're all surviving. You know, when you're in the box of knowable and unknowable, controllable and uncontrollable, what matters more than anything right now is really two questions. One is, what is your purpose? Because if you can't plan for something, getting to the top of something, which we now have to set down, which I think is a good thing, your purpose matters more than anything because it's your North Star. And secondly is, as that box of controllable and knowable gets smaller around what we actually can influence and the tsunami of change that's happening, the only thing you can do is it can affect is your choices, which is kind of Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, which means it asks the question, what is the next right thing every day, starting over, not with long-term ideas, but with what is the next right thing I need to do in order today into my purpose? And that's really how I'm leading myself and the company now, is answering those two questions and making sure that they're right when I begin my days. And I use those tool sets to govern my own operating system so that I answer them well. So that was a long answer to a very powerful question you asked.
Wise answer. And yeah, thank you for taking the time to go into those details there. You mentioned deep work, and this can mean, you know, so many different things. If you're willing to share, you know, I would love to hear about the type of work you've done, whether that's working with a coach or psychologist or therapist. I would love to hear more about what that deep work is.
So I don't know if you've read Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind, but I encourage you to read it. I'm a huge advocate of, you know, living a spiritual life, and that can mean a lot of things for a lot of different people. And certainly I grew up in a family of strong faith, and mine has evolved over the years quite dramatically, but I, you know, the spiritual center is still the same. My understanding is quite radically different, but it's still, underneath it all, it's the same. The deep work I've done is really around using tools to kind of understand how you got to where you are, and sort of and answer that question with absolute clarity, and then how to know yourself. And I think that those are, if you read How to Change Your Mind, you can understand those tools more clearly. But I would say that the construct I think a lot about now is our view of like our base reality, or like, which is, there's the reality we live in, and that reality, I personally believe, is really the construct that lives. Imagine the letter T, of which the top of the T is our lives, our reality. And the base of that, the T part of it, the perpendicular part, is really our choices. But choices are really just intention. What is the intention of my choice that leads to the outcomes of my life? And so what's underneath that T is really the question of why. Why do I intentionally make these choices that lead to this reality I live in? And until you can answer the why, you really can't change the intention of the choice that changes your life. And so I think the most important work that we have to do in deep work, whether you meditate, pray, get counsel, or you use tools like I have, is to answer the question of why. How did I get here to make these choices, and why do I do them? What I've discovered is that there's typically two or three things in your life that happened to you very young, and that either create shame in you or create disruption. And for me, it was around a physical scar, and it was about some changes in my family as a very young age that really, you know, led me to perform, right? You know, to cover those hidden shames or those senses of failure or the things that you want to overcome. And eventually the kind of classic things that make you feel better, the kind of credit or performance or the things that make you feel better, become like dope, right? They become like a dope addict of performance. And you eventually can no longer see yourself because you're covering yourself in performance. And so whether it's your work or your sports or, you know, so for some people, it becomes more tragic, addictions and drug, et cetera, they lose themselves in all this. And they no longer can see who's underneath it all. And so you dig a little hole, and you only need a little hole when you're young, but you know, you do that 20, 30 years, you die in the bottom of that hole. And very often people kind of blow up their whole life and start digging again, right? Same hole. So the question is how do you end that? And the answer to that for me was understanding about my relationship with myself, my soul, God, and learning that underneath the why, the profound insight for me, the breakthrough, was that there was actually only one of two choices. So underneath the T, right, our reality, our intentional choices, and the why underneath that was really only one of two choices, and that was love or fear. And once you can return yourself to this and you can see the question, the relationship you have through those lenses, you can really reclaim yourself and your life by asking the question is, am I leading decisions through love or fear? And especially now where there's fear everywhere and there's control biases and we are, you know, we're just surviving. My counsel people is to back up, deeply think about your purpose, think about doing the next right thing, but most importantly is make decisions in your life that are through abundance and love for yourself, for others in the world, because that sounds sort of soft, but it's actually totally profound when you ask, how am I living and have I lived most of my life as a performance dope act through fear? And to me, that's where the transformation begins. And having been there doing this now for several years, it's really been, Bionic is a reflection of this in my life as writing and is where I am in the journey. I'm quite open about that. I don't know if that resonates or not. I know it's a lot, but I could talk about that for hours.
Strongly. Yeah. Yeah. It's such a good reminder. And yeah, I'm a fan of Michael Pollan and recently did some work for PTSD with MDMA. Actually, over the course of the last 6 months, I've dove into that pretty wholeheartedly. And it's just like you mentioned, it ultimately gets back to that love versus fear dichotomy. And dealing with those childhood experiences is so, so important.
Yeah.
It's been said that the best investors ask about, you know, markets and products, or excuse me, the worst investors or average investors ask about products. And then the best ones ask about childhoods. And not always, but you kind of get the gist of that.
Yeah.
And so it's so important. And what a time we have right now to begin that work.
Yeah. I mean, this is really the question of proprietary gift. Where does it come from? So this is where you and I are, at least our energies are focused on. So I have done, very significant deep work with MDMA and psilocybin with guides and work. I've never experienced things tribally, but I've used them to sort of drain the conscious ocean. And then, you know, the way I describe it is like, you know, you're kind of bobbing around at the top of the surface in your conscience reality and like you're human, you're conscious in your meat suit. And, you know, and below that is who you are. It's the ocean. And so it covers, you know, how you got there, the algorithms. And so, you know, MBNA in a way drains the ocean. So you can walk along the topography and geology of your life to understand how you got to where you are and see. And so psilocybin in a way allows you to go back to the bottom, dive into the ocean, but talk to the mountains, right? And experience them, not only be known, but to experience the healing of how you got there, but the conversations that you need to have, those experiences, so you can move forward. And so those are very, very powerful tools, I think, are totally life-changing, and I strongly encourage people to do them. But I would do them under the supervision of a guide who specializes in them, because I don't think they're recreational things to take on. I think they do them with an absolute intent.
Completely agree. Yeah, there's nothing recreational about it for sure, but there is something that's ineffable about it that you just can't put into words.
Yeah.
But is so, so interesting. David, this has been a fascinating conversation. Thank you for being generous with your time here. If there is a final thought or call to action you'd like to leave all of our listeners with, would love to hear it. The show is called Hidden in Plain Sight. So would love for you to take it away and kind of tell folks what you're excited about, or maybe give them one piece of encouragement.
Thank you for that, Chad. It's very, very generous of you. I would say that, I wrote The Purpose of Bionic 7 years ago. It was about reigniting growth revolutions, right? And I always think about that in like startups and money and success to some extent for our partners and for ourselves. But in reality, that work is really about the interior life of the leader. Is that in a way, both for them and for ourselves, like we are the ceiling. We are the permission. And so one of the biggest insights this entire journey is really creating the permission and yourself to set down old beliefs, to set down old goals, biases, and pick up new ones. That's really at the center of this. And most people kind of, even they want change, they're kind of like hanging on to one trap, the trapeze beam of the past, and they have one hand, the other one, their arms are being ripped out, and they kind of swing back and forth, but they're really stuck. And so I really just encourage people to, you know, change the permission in your life, you to believe new things about yourself, what's possible. I'm going to continue to write about this and speak about this often. You can get me at david@onbionic.com. You can see Bionic at onbionic.com. You can also reach me at davidskidder@davidskidder.com. So lots of different places to stay in contact. But most importantly is that I'd let go of the surviving trapeze bar and I grab onto the thriving and winning one, which is really about permission. So grant yourself the permission to live with responsible abundance and make choices in love.
That one's easier to hold on to. David, thank you so much for joining us and everyone listening. We'll see you next time.
I'm Sophia Bush, and you've been listening to Hidden in Plain Sight from mission.org. This podcast is sponsored by our friends at Splunk, the Data to Everything platform. In today's data-driven world, every company, big or small, new or old, is sitting on terabytes of unused, untapped, and unknown data. Splunk helps turn all that data into action. Using cutting-edge AI and machine learning, Splunk delivers real-time predictive insights that will help you on your mission to change the world. With solutions for IT, security, Internet of Things, and business operations, Splunk empowers people to make faster, better decisions and take action to get things done. It's time for our data to be more than a record of what happened. It's time to make things happen. Check it out at splunk.com.